of the world's most controversial leaders are meeting in Beijing this week. North Korea's Kim Jong-un, Russia's Vladimir Putin, and China's Xi Jinping. It's a gathering that could shift the balance of power in Asia and the world. It's News Talk Daily. I'm Ciara Doherty. And you'd really wonder what Xi is hoping to achieve by hosting these two autocrats for the 80th anniversary celebrations of the end of World War II. Will Kim and Putin use the stage to project strength? And what does this mean, this axis of authoritarian leaders, mean for global geopolitics? Well, joining me to explore these questions is Robert E. Kelly, Professor of International Relations at Pusan National University in South Korea. You really are very welcome to News Talk Daily.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start with Kim Jong-un. He's been the supreme leader of North Korea since 2011, taking over from his father and his grandfather before that. He's had a few bilateral meetings. I suppose the one of most significance that we all would have tuned into was that meeting with Trump. But largely, he's been quite reclusive, I think, as a leader. And he certainly hasn't attended these international multilateral meetings in the past.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you're an autocrat, traveling is pretty risky. You know, that's actually fairly typical, especially in North Korea, where politics is, you know, basically a blood sport, right? I mean, if you lose, you get executed. So North Korean leaders typically don't travel very much. This particular North Korean leader, he came into office young and he knew fewer people behind the scenes who would sort of run the country and stuff like that. So for a while there, his power base was kind of shaky. There was some thinking maybe the army might try to overthrow him because he was much less rooted in the system than his father and his grandfather. But, you know, he's turned out to be a pretty stable autocrat. He has traveled twice out of the country. That sort of comes to mind. Like you said, the two meetings with Donald Trump. He's been to Beijing a couple times, too. But that, of course, isn't so tricky because it's closer. But I mean, yeah, I don't think he's gone out of the country more than five times in, what, 15 years now. So, yeah, it's pretty significant. And certainly, I think there's a greater sense that he is vulnerable when he leaves than, say, Vladimir Putin, right, who's been in power much longer and has really locked up the Russian system.
So given that risk, talk to me about how he travels when he does leave North Korea.
Right. So the most famous sort of way that these guys have traveled in the past, the Kims have traveled, is in this sort of like special bullet train, or this sort of armored train, you know, that does like can absorb like a rocket strike and stuff like that. I believe that's what Kim is taking now. His father was very afraid of flying, and so he actually only rode around the country on rail. This Kim is actually a little bit more comfortable flying. He, you know, he flew to meet Trump in Singapore and then again in Hanoi. But, you know, it looks like he took the train. I presume the train is probably safer because it's armored and, you know, he can have his whole retinue with him and stuff like that. I've flown into North Korea and the airlines are pretty terrifying. So you don't actually want to fly in North Korea. I've flown in North Korea and you don't want to fly in North Korea if you don't have to. So, you know, because Beijing is within train distance, that's probably why he did it.
And I know some analysts have noted the real slow pace of that train. It goes at about 60 kilometres per hour. It shows his willingness to prioritise security, certainly above speed.
Sure. Well, in North Korea, the rail system in North Korea is pretty poor, too, right? I mean, North Korea is really dilapidated. I mean, this is one of the things you notice when you go to North Korea. Once you leave the capital city, infrastructurally, the country just, it basically looks like a third world state. I mean, it really does. You know, Pyongyang, the capital, is okay. But once you leave, infrastructure is terrible. The water is brown. Electricity doesn't work. Roads are washed out. Bridges are few. And so the rail system, you know, we know from defectors and their literature, when they've come to South Korea, they write books and stuff. And they've talked about sort of how the rail system in North Korea is really slow and the tracks, you know, crack and stuff. So I would imagine that some of it's that. It's just the quality of the infrastructure. In China, it should be better.
Let's actually look at life within North Korea. I've spent a lot of the last 24 hours trying to read what I could about what everyday life is like for North Koreans. And the one thing that you do see immediately is that there's very little information about what life is like,
right,
particularly since Kim Jong-un took the reins in 2011.
Right.
It is, as you say, one of the world's most isolated and authoritarian countries. How has he ruled the country since he took that position?
So North Korea has had information from the outside world floating around the country for a good 30 years. Since the late 1990s, there was a terrible famine, and so people were pressed to leave the country because otherwise they were going to starve. And they went to China, and they brought back food, but they also brought back a lot of information. So North Korea is not the sealed society that it was. Instead, what the regime does is it basically sort of hunts down and puts into prison people that it catches using foreign technologies. You know, they're watching South Korean movies and flash keys and stuff like that. But the information card on is not nearly as sealed as much as it was before. But this Kim, what's different about this Kim than I think than his father is that he's more willing to use the power of the state to go after these people. His father was kind of like, whatever. He didn't really care that much as long as his rule wasn't threatened. You know, the previous Kim was kind of decadent. He was like a drunk. You know, this guy is a little bit more, this Kim, Kim Jong-un, is a little bit more focused and a little bit more insistent on sort of maintaining a police state. So it is repressive, as you were saying, but the information control will never be as thick as it was before because of those relationships with China.
Yeah, I'm looking at some of the legislation that he brought in, the Reactionary Ideology and Culture Rejection Act. And this basically says anybody who tries to smuggle a foreign video into the country, distribute it, can actually be executed. That's the consequence there. And he is willing to follow through on this.
Yeah, I mean, if you actually go to, I think it's like Amnesty International or Human Rights Watch, you know, if you go to these big sort of NGOs, Freedom House and stuff, and you sort of look at their ranking of like the most repressive countries in the world, North Korea is always in the top two or three. It's up there with like Turkmenistan. I mean, it's a really extreme state. There's been sort of UN human rights investigations and stuff like that that have argued that North Korea's concentration camp system is akin to what you had in Nazi Germany. I mean, like literally, you know, I mean, that kind of brutality and that level of death. It's also worth pointing out when it comes to the concentration camp system that the gulags provide basically a steady supply of free labor in a country where the economy doesn't work very well. So there's an economic argument for basically rousting people off the street and saying they didn't cry enough in front of the statues or something, because then you can throw them into a camp and you can like work them in the mines or in the forest or something like that, you know, 12 hours a day and not pay them. Right. I mean, it's kind of like a economically useful slave labor system.
So there's severe repression there, severe Definitely. Control. And it appears a lot of fear from Kim that if the people of North Korea get a sense of the freedoms enjoyed by people living in the rest of the world, that perhaps there would be some more dissent and some threat to his leadership and to the Kim dynasty.
Right. Hence all the repression. I mean, North Koreans know that South Korea is wealthier and like has, you know, bright lights and big city and all that kind of stuff. That information can never be pushed back out of North Korea. That's known. And so instead, the strategy of the state is to repress, right, to sort of throw people in jail. You were mentioning the various laws and stuff like that. But it's all that story. So repression is obviously key. But that story is also a little bit complicated because there has never been anything like Arab Spring or the Velvet Revolution, you know, or 1848 or the French Revolution. I mean, there is a debate about this, and we don't know because North Korea doesn't tell us anything. But there is a debate. There is an observation that there's never been a revolt in North Korea ever. And, you know, there's never been a popular uprising. There's never been, you know, there are bread riots and stuff like that occasionally, but nothing that ever got off the ground. And so there is this kind of argument out there that like, well, maybe people actually believe all the stories about the Kim cult. Maybe they believe that the Kims can control the weather and that they're divine. And I don't know. I mean, we don't know, right? But the defector literature that we have is kind of all over the place on this. A lot of the defectors talk about how like they dream about the Kims and they're like they're in their head and they're in their brain because they're propagandized from when they were little kids. So some of it might be compliance. It might not just be the stick.
But also, there's a real difficulty within North Korea because they have these sort of weekly life review meetings that every individual is obliged to attend. And at those, you're encouraged to confess your mistakes and your wrongdoings. And again, to dob in any of your neighbours if you suspect that they are speaking ill of the Kims. So there must be no trust in society.
Yeah, so there is the sort of neighborhood watch system, the neighborhood sort of telling on each other kind of system, which is, you know, something, you know, that like if you read 1984, like that's in 1984. The struggle session thing where you like meet and you talk about how you're like not sufficiently fervid up for the revolution that they got from Mao Zedong, right? The struggle sessions. The North Koreans have turned these up to 11, right? I mean, propaganda is really, really important in North Korea, right? Probably not because people believe it. Again, I mean, do you really believe someone can control the weather? But what it probably is, actually, it's a function, it's a sort of loyalty test, right? If you say that they believe in the weather, right, you're basically showing how loyal you are, right? So you can use propaganda to see who really, you know, was willing to sort of like surrender all their common sense to the regime. And then you can see the people like, yeah, well, maybe he can't control the weather. And then you know someone, then you have a line on someone who might be a resistor or a dissenter. And so there's a debate about like what the purpose of ideology is in North Korea. But definitely it's ideological. I mean, they make him go to school and they teach it to him, sure.
So this is why his presence on Wednesday at this parade to mark the end of World War II is so significant, because standing on stage beside Xi Jinping, beside Vladimir Putin, it legitimizes his leadership and his authoritarian dictatorship.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, if you're North Korea, you know, North Korea was really badly isolated for a long time in the 90s and 2000s. That had the terrible famine. You know, some of your viewers or your listeners, if they're old enough, might remember back, you know, 30 years ago, people thought North Korea was going to collapse. They were like, you know, it's the next domino and all these communist states are disappearing, you know. But now the Kims have managed to hang on, and now it's great, right? Because the Russians are giving them money to help with the Ukraine war, and China kind of pays their bills and gives them low-cost petroleum and stuff like that, right? So this whole axis of authoritarianism that you were mentioning that we're talking about now a lot in the West, you know, are like China and Russia and North Korea and Iran. Are they kind of like some kind of axis of evil part two or something or other? That's great if you're North Korea, right? Because then you're not isolated. Then you're not this like weird backward state, you know, some Marxist tyranny from 50 years ago. Instead, you're part of this sort of like up and coming clique of these authoritarians who are going to challenge the American system. And so, yeah, so I think that's probably one of the reasons why Kim went, because it makes North Korea look less weird.
Is he emboldened, do you feel, by the relationship that he has developed with Vladimir Putin?
Yeah, I think, well, I don't think he's emboldened enough to actually like, take like a big risk and like attack South Korea. I actually don't think that the North Koreans are that risky. If they're going to do it, they probably would have done it already. But I think the relationship with Russia is giving the North Koreans some room to move really on two things. The first is the North Koreans are now less dependent on China because they have an alternative patron in Russia, which means they don't have to sort of do what the Chinese tell them they have to do. Because the Chinese have traditionally kind of bullied the North Koreans on, you know, like disarmament talks. Like the Chinese basically forced Kim Jong-un to go and meet Donald Trump, even though the North Koreans thought nothing was going to come of it. Now North Korea has some room to resist. And that also gives North Korea some room to resist. The Russia relationship also gives North Korea some room to resist South Korea. You know, the North Koreans had originally kind of hoped that the South Koreans would give them aid and detente and stuff like that. But hey, if the Russians are giving you all this money for your soldiers and you don't care about your own people and you don't care if they're getting, you know, destroyed by drones in Ukraine, it's great for North Korea, right? You can just sort of use your soldiers as mercenaries and take the Russian money. And it looks like that's what the North has been doing for the last couple of years.
And I presume all of the propaganda from his attendance at this celebration on Wednesday will be played out across networks in North Korea as a real show of strength. And it says to the people, he is being recognized internationally as a fellow leader.
Right. It's going to be wall to wall, just like it was with Trump.
How might the parades and the summit, the economic summit that is happening at the moment, which I know he's actually not attending, how will that serve Xi Jinping's broader goals?
So I think, again, this kind of like is something of a legitimation exercise, right? I mean, this sort of makes look like China is this rising force and it's kind of displacing the United States. And that's certainly how Xi Jinping has talked for like the last 5 or 6 years. There's a lot of sort of American argument that, well, this is sort of a precursor to like a Chinese attack on Taiwan. I'm not so sure about that, but I do think that the Chinese generally, and this is certainly my experience going to China at conferences and so on, that they feel like their time is come, that the Americans are decadent, the Americans are slipping. You know, the Americans had the Iraq War and then Katrina and then the Great Recession, the real estate implosion. Then the Americans elected Donald Trump and he's just all over the place. You know, I think the Chinese perception is the Americans are stumbling again and again and again, that Pax Americana or the American Empire, whatever you want to call it, is eroding and that this is their time. And certainly Xi Jinping talks this way. And I think that's one of the reasons why you have all these leaders coming. The Chinese really want all of them up there. The North Koreans, the Indians, the Russians, the whole bit. It makes China look like a legitimate peer competitor to U.S. power.
It will also be a massive opportunity for them to showcase the military and how it has been modernized.
Yeah, sure. definitely. Yeah, I mean, there'll be lots of parades and we'll see lots of new Chinese missiles and stuff like that. You know, and you know behind the scenes, too, that the Chinese and the Russians are going to be making deals because we know a lot of Chinese support is going into the Ukraine war. And the Russians are also getting North Korean armaments. So there's probably going to be that, too. You know, the North Koreans are making out really, really well from the Ukraine mess. They're getting paid for the soldiers who are getting killed. They don't care about them. And the Russians are also giving them missile technology. You know, I mean, the North Koreans are making out like bandits.
So what's interesting about this is that we would have thought perhaps that it was all about optics. It's all about symbolism. It is this new world order, this new fourth that does not need Western help right. or influence. But actually, it is more than that. You said there will be some solid deal making going on behind the scenes at the conference, which is a precursor to this parade on Wednesday.
Yeah, I would imagine so. I mean, the Russians really are struggling in Ukraine, right? I mean, if we in the West, if we really ramp up aid to Ukraine, I think the Ukrainians can, if not win, they can certainly force the Russians eventually to sort of sue for some kind of peace deal. You know, the Russians are going to the Iranians, they're going to the North Koreans. Try to imagine a great power. You think you're a great power and you're going to the North Koreans. You know, I mean, North Korean ammunition has been sitting in warehouses for 40 years. The dud rate is like 30-40%. And the Russians are still buying it because they're so desperate. And so I think that's probably what you're going to get there, is that Putin's going to go around talking to the Chinese and the North Koreans and be like, you need me to win this war. This is the leading edge of our common struggle against, you know, the liberal international order. And so, you know, help me. And I think the Chinese and the North Koreans are going to do so, because they have been for the last couple of years.
So how does the timing then of his visit to China intersect with U.S. diplomatic efforts and Trump's renewed interest in trying to meet with him?
So I would imagine that because the first time Trump was in there, the Kim and Trump met three times and nothing came of it. I would imagine that the North Koreans are not going to agree to a Trump meeting unless there's something much more significant on the table than there was last time. Basically, of the three meetings back in 2018-19, only one of them, the one in Hanoi in 2018, was really serious, where they actually negotiated. But the negotiation only lasted, you may remember, like about an hour to an hour and a half, and then Trump like stormed out of the room. So, I mean, literally, like, he like stood up and like flipped up the chair and just marched out. And so the whole thing kind of fell apart. So if you're the North Koreans, I mean, you're not going to do that again, right? I mean, Kim Jong-un is not going to make Donald Trump look nice and TV and give him all that attention, you know, and all that media coverage without getting something. And right now he doesn't have to talk to us because he can go to the Russians. So I would imagine if Trump wants to go to North Korea, the North Korean price has gone up significantly. They're going to ask for more than just sanctions relief. They're going to ask for money. They're going to ask for diplomatic recognition. They're going to ask for a lot. And I don't know if Trump has the political support to do that at home.
What are the risks for the West here, Robert, in observing this close coordination between China, now Russia, and North Korea?
So there's the ongoing risk that the more closely they're aligned, and if they actually become like an axis and not like just a gang of authoritarians that all don't like us, they actually sort of function like an axis, like a real alliance, that would actually be pretty frightening, because that would mobilize a lot of power behind the Russian effort to take over Ukraine.
Because right? they're not that yet. There is nothing sort of formal in place yet.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I mean, there's nothing like sort of like, so like, you know, like in World War II, right? You know, like the British and the Americans had like a combined command and stuff like that, and they really worked together against the Nazis. You don't have that kind of commitment. But if you did, that would certainly help the Russians in Ukraine. I would have bet that the Russians were willing to make some concessions in order to get something like that. But I think the bigger threat in the future is that if the Chinese can really line up the Russians and the North Koreans and others behind them over Taiwan, that's the really big issue, of course, because a Taiwan conflict would likely lead to a U.S.-Chinese conflict, and who knows where that's going to go. That's the big fear I have.
What do you expect then to hear at the end of this summit and this parade and all of these bilateral meetings that are going to happen right. over the next couple of days? What will the messaging be from that?
Yeah, it's going to be all what we were talking about at the beginning. Sort of, this is a new era and unipolarity is over. American hegemony is over. We're in this new multipolar world where, you know, other states outside of the Western liberal order have a voice and stuff like that. Putin loves to talk like this. You know, the Chinese will talk like that, too, because the Chinese are trying to sort of like act like this liberal leadership voice for the global South, particularly, and sort of argue that you should stand with us as developing countries against, you know, the tyranny of these wealthy states and stuff. But I think, you know, if you're the Chinese, it's a little bit tricky because I don't think the Chinese actually want multipolarity, right? I don't think the Chinese actually see themselves as, like, for example, as like a peer to the Russians. The Russians desperately want the Chinese to see them that way, but I don't think the Chinese think that way. The Chinese economy is now like 15 times the size of the Russian economy. You know, Russia would be in real trouble in Ukraine if they weren't being supported by the Chinese or buying their oil and everything else and supplying them with parts for the drones and stuff. You know, so I mean, if you're Xi Jinping, I'm not sure if you want to go in too much for this sort of like, you know, this new future is sort of like we're all equal. I don't think that's actually what the Chinese want. I think they want to displace the United States. You know, yeah, I think the Chinese would rather displace the United States at the top of the pile rather than sort of reduce the pile into sort of like equal spheres of influence. So I think there's some room there for us to sort of like exploit differences between the Russians and the Chinese.
And when you look actually at the members the states that are attending this summit and this parade on Wednesday, I mean, you're talking 43% of the world's population represented here, 23% of the world's GDP. I mean, there's a lot of clout here, a lot of it coming from China, of course.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's, again, part of the symbolism, right? That sort of China is this sort of like leader and it's like leading this large block of countries, all of which share this sort of resentment at, you know, Western leadership or American domination or whatever you want to call it. That's kind of what the BRICS have become, you know, the BRICS sort of alliance, whatever that clique is also, I think, kind of primarily geared against sort of saying there's an alternative path out there, there's a different way. You know, Chinese state capitalism, for example, represents a different development alternative than just Western capitalism and markets and stuff. And so for the Chinese, again, I mean, this is like a chance to look like all these countries are kind of like with you and you provide this alternative to the United States. You know, it's not just sort of unipolarity and American hegemony and you have to sort of use the dollar only and you always have to talk to Washington. Right. And so I think that's the message that we're all going to be hearing for the next week or so.
Well, fascinating times. Robert E. Kelly, thank you so much for speaking to us from South Korea. That's it from News Talk Daily. We'll be back again tomorrow with another edition. And make sure that you do check out newstalk.com or the Go Loud Player to catch up on any episodes you might have missed. But from me, Ciara Doherty, goodbye.